Who doesn't like to roam around the world, especially if you're looking for some treasure? Who doesn't like a treasure hunt, especially when there's always more treasure to be found? Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, talking about treasure, the treasure hunt of geocaching today. And we've got some experienced geocachers, or as they call themselves, purveyors of fine Tupperware, with us today. One of them, Rebecca Dauterman, is the vice president of the Wisconsin Geocaching Association. Rebecca, thanks for joining us. Oh, Carson, Rebecca's not with us. Carson Monroe is with us, the secretary of the Wisconsin Geocaching Association. Carson Monroe, welcome. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Yeah, I think Rebecca might have had a phone issue. Hopefully she's going to be on with us again in a moment.
I am back now.
Okay, Rebecca, thanks for joining us. Glad
thanks
that we have
us.
You back. You're not lost.
Not today, I'm not. Nope.
Oh, my goodness. So you guys are both with the Geocaching Association of Wisconsin. Rebecca, what do you guys do as part of the association? Oh, did we lose her again? Carson, you can talk then.
Well, we really promote geocaching in the state of Wisconsin, and we work with the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, to make sure that we can continue to enjoy our game in public spaces throughout the state.
And let's talk a bit more about, you know, exactly what I'm sure there are people who don't know what the heck is geocaching. So let's talk about that. I don't think Rebecca's back with us yet. So Carson, can you talk about it?
Sure. So geocaching really became possible when global positioning system, the GPS system, the U.S. government decided to turn off something called selective availability, which really improved the accuracy of consumer-grade GPS devices. That happened in 2000, and shortly thereafter, somebody decided that they were going to hide a container somewhere in the world and post the GPS coordinates online so that other people could go find it as well. And that's sort of how geocaching began. Obviously, it's come a long way in 20 years. Now there are hundreds and thousands and even millions of geocaches in the world. I'm in the Madison area, and we have probably 1,000 in the general metro area, I would guess, hidden all over the place in various shapes and sizes. And so really the game is about going somewhere that someone else has been and hidden the container and finding the container yourself, with a goal being to sign a log sheet or a logbook inside the container and then post on the geocaching.com website to share a little bit about your experience finding the cache.
Really cool. And Rebecca, how did you get involved in this? How did you get started in geocaching?
Mine was back actually when I was a kid. My dad was a surveyor when I was growing up, and he actually showed it to me as kind of just a little fun activity for us to do. And lost touch with it for a couple of years, but about 5 to 6 years when I was in college, a friend of mine was getting her kids into geocaching, and she sort of reintroduced it to me. We had gone during class, on our lunch between classes, we had gone and found a geocache that was on the college campus here in Wausau, and kind of never looked back.
Never looked back. And now, as part of the, what does the association itself do in support of geocaching? Can you talk about that?
I'll take that one. We do a lot of, as far as a lot with the community, as far as geocaching groups. If anyone wants to, is holding a class with, say, the Boy Scouts or at a school or just a, you know, general event in their town, they can contact us and we can help provide information if they need a PowerPoint, if they need some help reserving a shelter, that kind of thing. But also we host our own series events. We have 3 to 4 usually annually on a normal year. This year has, of course, proved difficult.
Yeah.
But we do a spring camp out. We do a fall picnic. We do a lonely cash game event, which is a little bit different. And then we also do a chili feed in, when is that usually, about January, Carson? March?
January, February, I think.
January, February. Okay. Somewhere in there, we do a chili feed.
Oh, okay. So kind of a chance to get out there and do some locating, but then also have a good time and get to meet some other people who are involved and like what you guys like. So how do you know where to find a geocache?
Like everything else, there is an app for that.
Yes, exactly. There's an app for that, and there's a website for that. At this point, you can use whatever combination floats your boat. But the way most people are going to get into geocaching is through an app on their smartphone. And it is generally free to play the game. There is a premium membership for $30 a year that gives you some additional features. But if you just want to get a taste, you can download the geocaching app, and it'll pull up a map and it'll show you what's around you. It'll highlight what should be an easier cache to find, and you can go see what you can find.
So if you get the exact coordinates, it seems like, oh, it shouldn't be all that hard to find.
Theoretically, I mean, when someone's out there trying to get the coordinates, I mean, I've seen it anywhere from, yeah, it's dead on, you know, but I've also seen it up to 300-400 feet away as far as the coordinates being off. So good luck.
Yeah. So what is a coordinate? Go ahead. You were going to say something too.
I was going to say, as a general rule of thumb, even the best GPS devices, consumer grade GPS devices and smartphones, they're usually only going to get you within about 15 to 20 feet of the coordinates. And you have to also consider that that's true of the person that placed the cache and was trying to get the coordinates, which is what Rebecca was referring to. So if they're 15 to 20 feet off and you're potentially 15 to 20 feet off, you know, 30 to 40 feet is reasonable. You're going to be in the right area. And we tend to call that area ground zero, where this is the general area where you're going to find the cache. But in my experience, I'm rarely standing on the cache when my device zeroes out. Right. So at that point, it's kind of like, okay, it's somewhere here. And then you have to start trying to think like a geocacher. Where would I hide this thing? Usually you have a rough idea of the size of the container. And so that may limit your possibilities or not, depending on where you're at. And you really got to look around and, you know, search in a relatively small space. But yeah, once you get there, it doesn't mean that it's going to be easy going from that point.
And what does, and they're not just sitting out on top of a fence post or something. They're hidden away a bit, I assume.
Usually, yes. Now, sometimes they are intentionally very obvious, but I would say that is rare. Usually they're designed such that they're hidden away. And that could be, you know, if you're in the woods, it could be, you know, in a hollow log or a hollow stump, or, you know, concealed in a little grouping of trees or things like that. If you're geocaching in the city, the containers are likely to be much, much smaller. Sometimes they're magnetic and they'll be like on the underside of railing or the backside of a fence, guardrail, those sorts of things. So generally they're not going to be in plain sight. Usually when they are, they're something a little bit special. Someone has made what we call a gadget cache, where there are specific things you have to do in order to open the container. And those are usually going to be clearly labeled so that people know what they are. But I would say those are not the norm. Usually they're going to be concealed. And part of the reason we try to do that is because not everybody knows about our game. And sometimes the containers will get removed, which obviously damages the game if you can't find the thing that's supposed to be there. So usually hidden works out better for everybody.
And we've got Marcus from Green Bay on. Marcus, hang on, and I hope you can hang on through our newscast here. He's got something to talk about that I think is kind of fun, too, relating to geocaching. But I tell you what, Rebecca Dowderman and Carson Monroe from the Wisconsin Geocaching Association, our guests today, they'll be with us right up till 12:30. Take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we will be back. So you stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. You can roam around the world geocaching if you'd like. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Talking about geocaching in Wisconsin today, what it is, how to do it, and some favorite caches as well. Two guests for you from the Wisconsin Geocaching Association. One, Rebecca Dowderman, is the vice president. Carson Monroe is the group secretary, also joining us. Marcus has been waiting through the news to talk with us from Green Bay. So let's go there. Marcus, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for taking my call, Larry.
Sure.
I missed the beginning of the show. When did geocaching start around here in Wisconsin?
So I did mention the beginning of geocaching was about May of 2000, and the first caches in Wisconsin, I think, were put out in late 2000, early 2001. Obviously, it's picked up a lot since then, but it's been around quite a while in the state.
Yeah. Marcus, did you have you had an experience to share?
Well, a couple of them. There's a place in Green Bay called Bird's Creek, and I used to explore that when I was a kid and everything. And I had a favorite oak tree that had a big open trunk. I think it got hit by lightning. And I was exploring the tree, looking at the tree. I found a film canister in there, and I didn't know anything about geocaching. And there was a little note in there. I can't remember what it said. But the other thing was, I used to ride the trails on my bicycle, my mountain bike, at night. And I had all these LED lights and stuff when I first came out. And there was reflectors in the woods. And that's where people put geocaching. Like, it was a hint. Do you know what I mean? Or
yeah, right. It sounds like you're referring to a night cache. So this is kind of a variant type of cache where people will put something out intending for it to be found at night, and they will use reflectors like you're describing to help guide people in the right direction.
Very, very cool. And so, and the first one he found may or may not have been probably was a geocache. Are they sometimes stored in film containers?
I have seen everything from ammo cans to peanut butter jars to pill bottles to, yes, film canisters. I've seen containers that are about the size of my fingernail. I've seen people use just about anything you can fit a piece of paper in.
And what do they find when they typically, what do you find when you open it?
So the bare minimum is you need to have a log. So that can be just a piece of paper. It can be a bigger notebook. That kind of depends on the size of the cache. That's the bare minimum expectation, because you have to sign the log to prove that you were there before you can claim your find online. But on the larger containers, cachers do like to put in trade items, or some people call it swag, stuff we all get, which I think is kind of a bad moniker, because it should be stuff we all can trade, right? The idea is if there are items in the cache and you would like to take something out, you need to put something in of equal or greater value so that there are always items to trade in the cache. And I know that's one of the things. I have two daughters, 5 and 7. That's one of the things they like most about geocaching is they get to go find treasure, and they enjoy sifting through, see what items are in the cache and pull something out and then decide what to trade in its place.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Marcus, thank you so much. Let's take a call from Rich in Two Rivers, Wisconsin. Hi, Rich.
Hey, lad. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, it's kind of on a different course, but I boat Lake Michigan all the time, and I have an older GPS that's really accurate, but if it really wants to get accurate, it keys in on a satellite, and it says acquired WAAS, and I don't know what the difference is. I'm probably military, but whatever the case is, I mean, how much more accurate? Because sometimes I'm in the fog, and if I'm coming into the piers, you want to be within 3 or 4 feet of your marker on your GPS. And that's all I have to ask.
Okay, thank you for calling. Marcus, or I'm sorry, Carson or Rebecca, a comment on that? On what's the difference?
As far as I know with the satellites, I know there's the U.S. satellites and there's some Russian satellites and everything. And knowing from my dad from surveying and everything else, the longer that it sits there, the GPS unit sits in one location, the better accuracy you can get as far as reading your latitude, longitude, knowing that specific location that you are at. Now, if you're putting in coordinates that you're trying to get there, same concept. The longer that you sit there, then it'll, you know, be more accurate as far as how far away you are from the coordinates where you want to be.
My understanding
is that the WAAS is an augmentation system that actually uses ground stations in addition to the satellite signals to help better triangulate your specific location. So when your device indicates that is active, you should have a more reliable signal.
Ah, there you go. I've often wondered about that. I have something called Map My Run in my phone, and so when I go out in the morning for a run, I often run this 3-mile stretch, and when I go to the first mile in the morning and then I run again in the afternoon, usually there's a fair distance between when the little voice tells me I've reached a mile. You know what I mean? And I thought, well, maybe it's just the positioning of the satellites. Would that relate, or would that make sense to you, Carson or Rebecca?
I think that part of that depends on how the app is designed to function. I think most smartphone apps use a combination of things to figure out where they are. They'll use the location services of the device itself, of the operating system. And so they use a combination of Wi-Fi signals, known Bluetooth beacons, and GPS to sort of pinpoint your location. So whatever of those things it can use, it will. If you're running in the middle of nowhere, obviously you're not likely to have Bluetooth or Wi-Fi signals around you. And so you're primarily relying on the GPS. The way the device is positioned on your body is a factor, and how often the device is actually polling for location data is a factor. So it's really hard to know exactly what that's about. I will say that as it relates to geocaching, in my experience, my smartphone, an iPhone, is about as accurate as a dedicated GPS device, with some exceptions. The iPhone signal tends to not be quite as stable. It'll wander a little bit, but the accuracy is pretty good and usually good enough for what I need to go geocaching. Whereas a dedicated GPS device like a Garmin, usually will be about the same accuracy, but is a little more stable. It doesn't bounce around quite as much, not as affected by tree cover or things like that.
Yeah.
Agreed. And at least for me, I know, Carson, you're down in Madison, so you guys always have self-service. I'm located up in Merrill, northern Wisconsin, north central Wisconsin, and I use a combination of both my phone and my GPS units. I have a little Magellan unit that I use, but I use a combination of both because for the fact of if I'm going out in the woods, 50-50, I'm not going to have cell phone reception. So unless I'm downloading the caches to an offline list on my phone, I'm using my GPS just because it's going to get me a better signal, better location as far as telling me where I'm at versus where the cache is at.
Interesting.
Yeah, and well, I'm glad Becca said that. Before we move on, I want to make sure folks know a phone can receive a GPS signal even without data service, without typical cell service. The question is, can you access anything to know where the caches are? And that's where an offline list planned ahead of time comes in really handy.
Yeah, makes sense. Mark and Bloomer, we'll go to you now. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon, friends. My wife and I are planning our vacation for this summer. And, you know, we'd like to travel. We have three little kids. You ever travel with three little kids and they get crabby tired and mom gets crabby tired and I'm crabby tired? You take a geocache along and you say, we're going to stop for a little rest break and we're going to find a geocache or two. It's a great way to get the kids out to see a part of the nation that they're not going to see going to the national park or to a museum. We found wild blackberries one day. We didn't find the geocache, but we found the wild berries instead. But it's an amazing tool to use with kids. So you learn and see things that you never thought you'd learn and see.
That's a great comment. Rebecca?
Absolutely. I can honestly say it. One of the main reasons I love geocaching is it always gets me somewhere that I wouldn't normally go. And especially with kids, I have a 7-year-old who now has his own account. And it's a lot of fun for him because I can, you know, I pull it up on my phone and say, okay, you're the blue dot. You're going to go to the green dot. And away he goes, and he can focus on it. And especially on car rides, you know, if we need to stop every 2 hours, it's like, okay, well, here's a rest stop or a park or something down the road. And same thing, say, okay, go find it. And exactly, treasure hunting.
There you go. Well, we got a guy with a coaching nickname of Rum Dum from Madison. Let's go there. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hey, guys. I want to give kudos to Carson and Beck. Thanks for doing the work you guys do. It's very funny. I'm out doing a maintenance run on my geocaches right now and looking for new places to put them. And it is by far a ton of fun. I've gotten to all 72 counties because of this hobby. And I've seen all sorts of parts of Wisconsin I would have never seen if it wasn't for geocaching.
Well, that is very cool. Do you guys, Rebecca and Carson, do you know who Rum Dum is?
I have heard the name. Yes, I do.
Yes, I've been caching with him on multiple occasions, and I just want to ask him when he's going to hide some in my area so that I can enjoy them.
Oh, you know, it's the big bodies of water between our two sides of town that caused the issue, and I hate to step on somebody else's territorial toes. So
you're going to have to go to the other side of the lake, Carson.
Yep. Got to go to the east side.
So you could always come north. I need some new caches up here, too.
There you go.
Rum Dum does go north about once a year for a geocaching event, so, you know, 2 to 3.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks for calling, Rum Dum. Carol in Oshkosh, we'll go to you next. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Just wanted to share an experience. I was in Oklahoma at Christmas time visiting family, and my almost 7-year-old grandson had gotten a metal detector for Christmas. So we went out to a nature park, and he tried that out for a while, and then they decided to go geocaching. And it took them quite a while, but eventually he found something, and it was a box, metal box in a brushy area. And he was so excited, and it did have little, like, gift swag things in it. But it was, I can see how neat it is for kids, you know, to be persistent and keep looking. It was really fun. And I'm just a question, how has the COVID-19 affected geocaching?
Good question.
Yeah, it has definitely affected our game. I would say every person has to make their own decision about what they are and are not comfortable with. Some people have opted not to go out caching at all. Other people have decided this is actually a really great thing to be doing right now because you're generally not around people. And there are ways, I personally think there are ways to do it safely. But for the WGA, as Rebecca was saying earlier, we do have several events that we put on throughout the year. And every one of those events this year, except for our chili feed early on, has been canceled so far. We do have an event coming up in next month in July. That is going to be our first event, and not one that we would first event in a while, and not one that we normally would have held. But we decided to throw an extra one in. We also had a pause on new caches being published in the state. Geocaches get reviewed by volunteers before they are published to the website and the apps. And there was about a month and a half where no caches were being published, actually closer to 2 months, where no new caches were being published. But it was kind of like Christmas Day when the floodgates opened. I know in my area, there were a whole bunch of new ones, about 30 in a day. So that was exciting.
Yeah, and that was just for the state of Wisconsin. They had it paused for 2 months. I know some states, they were paused for a month. Some were paused for 6 weeks. I know there's, I believe, two or three states that are actually still paused. Well, yeah, and something I've always agreed with on the app, too, and even on the website when you first sign up for it and everything, was they do put a humorous disclaimer of geocache at your own risk. And I have always believed that as far as if you want to go out there and be safe, by all means, you know, bring sanitizer wipes and all that good stuff. But if you don't feel comfortable going out right now, that's fine.
Yeah, that's perfectly fine, too. Yeah. Thank you again, Carol, for your experience in Oklahoma. Janine in Rhinelander, it's your turn. Hi, Janine.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My son and his wife taught me about geocaching, and then I shared it with my husband. And now that we're both retired, geocaching has taken us to places in the world that we had never visited before, like in Italy or in Puerto Rico. And it does take you go to places that you don't even know about for this search or this sense of wonder, I call it, sense of wonder. So we really enjoy it. And you can enjoy it we've had grandchildren from ages 2 to 20. So it goes across the age brackets. Anyone can enjoy it.
That is very cool. Rebecca, a little comment there?
I love that it always takes you somewhere that you wouldn't normally go. I found everything from a hidden waterfall that we couldn't find on a map to an abandoned mine that driving by on the highway, you would never have known was there. And geocaching did that for us.
In my experience, anywhere that you want to go in general, there's probably a geocache there if there's something interesting to see. But the reverse is also true. Oftentimes, if there's a geocache there, there is also something interesting to see that you may never have known about.
Yeah, that's very cool. Chris in Black Creek, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Oh, hi, Larry. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. You've heard me before, owner and operator of crystalsforkids.org. So through the years, all the schools and kids' birthday parties and stuff, I would bury treasure chests with 60 to 70 gemmy items in a 5-gallon bucket instead of a film container. So I buried five of them in Chaffee County, Colorado, 12 years ago. And for special kids and stuff, I give them a map that's stained with tea and burned holes through it and folded up really weird, and they go on a treasure hunt. Well, out of those five, there's still one left from 12 years ago with 70 items in it, guys.
Well, that's pretty cool as well, isn't it, Carson?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's something that could never get approved as a geocache because ours aren't allowed to be buried, but that's pretty exciting that that's been out there that long. And some kid's going to find it, and their day will be made.
Oh, thanks, Chris. Jennifer in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Hi. I missed the beginning of the show, so I don't know if you did a comparison between letterboxing and geocaching. But letterboxing is actually the original geocaching before there were GPS units to direct you to a little hidden treasure. And letterboxing actually started in Europe, I think, in the 1800s. But you actually follow clues, written clues or stories, to get you to the letterbox. The problem I've been finding is that since geocaching started, geocaches often end up right in the same areas where letterboxes were previously planted. And when the geocachers find the letterbox, they actually take the rubber stamps out of the letterboxes. The stamps are used to stamp your logbook, and then you stamp their logbook with your stamp. So my stamps keep disappearing because the geocachers find them, and they think that their prizes are something to take with them. So I just wanted to make your listeners aware that there are two different things. Don't take the rubber stamps out of the letterboxes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a very good point. And actually, I'm sure this is mostly just folks that don't know any different. But there's actually a hybrid geocache type that is a letterbox and a geocache. And those are pretty typically listed as both, and there will be a stamp as you're describing, but the owners of those are very clear. The stamp is not a trade item. Do not take it. It needs to stay. But it's a great point and something that we probably could do a better job of educating people about.
Do you guys have a website, your association?
Absolutely. It is wi-geocaching.com.
wi-geocaching.com. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you both today. Rebecca and Carson, thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you. It's been fun.
Rebecca Dowderman is the vice president of the Wisconsin Geocaching Association. Carson Monroe is its secretary. Fun having them with us today. And as we roamed around Wisconsin and the nation, for that matter. Well, a lot of fun.